ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Om may Brahman protect us, both the preceptor and the student. May he nourish us both. May we work together with great energy. May our study be vigorous and fruitful. May love and harmony dwell amongst us. Om, peace, peace, peace. So this is the second class of the first section of five classes on yoga as a path to freedom. Swami Tattva Mayananda.
The last time we were discussing this problem of bondage and the problem of attaining freedom. Now, from a philosophical point of view, this bondage is only an illusion. The bondage is the feeling that we are bound, because bondage is never real. And freedom is only removal of this wrong notion that we are bound. Because if bondage is real, in the true sense of the term, real, then it is eternal. And freedom is eternal, therefore there was never a condition when you were not actually free. So when we talk about freedom, we are only talking about the removal of the wrong notion that we are not free, or the wrong notion that we are bound. From a philosophical point of view, I shall try to explain this. Now, you know, from the standpoint of Vedanta philosophy, there are different levels of concepts of freedom. From the highest point of view, as I said last time, we are inherently free. We are naturally free. Our true nature is freedom. Bondage is an illusion which somehow comes to us. Now, how does it come? The philosophical aspect of yoga philosophy, which is called Vedanta, gives one explanation. The term used is Maya very often. Said Vivekananda, the great monk who expounded this philosophy for the first time in America, he gave a graphic description of this concept of Maya. Originally, this word was used way back in the second century by the great Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna, who is the exponent of what we normally call the doctrine of emptiness or Shunyavada. So, but of course he used in a different sense. But in Vedantic tradition, Maya is expounded by Shankaracharya. He says Maya is something which is beyond description, beyond definition, beyond words. When we are within the state of the illusion of bondage, bondage is real for us. Because after all, we are what we think ourselves to be. What we think ourselves to be. If we think that we are really free, that moment we can be free. But that is not always possible. Because of our wrong identity, we identify ourselves with this body which comes and goes, which falls sick, and we think that there is nothing beyond this body. At a higher level, we may consider ourselves to be mind. Mind which feels happy and unhappy. Sometimes at a still higher level, we may think we are this intellect, as I explained last time. But in all these wrong associations, we have a kind of identity, wrong identity. So long as we are within the realm of, within the jurisdiction of this wrong identity, we remain in bondage. Now, the moment we realize that freedom is our true nature, when suddenly we recognize the fact the very concept of bondage was really an illusion. This is the highest Vedantic philosophy. I shall say a few things about Maya, which I already, because this is very important in understanding yoga and also Vedanta. Now, you know, if you read any English book, you find M-A-Y-A. This is how it is written. In Sanskrit, there are two letters. Ma is a long vowel, and Ya, which is also a long vowel. In Sanskrit language, in Sanskrit grammar, you use the word ma to mean something which doesn't exist. It is used as a negation. For example, I shall just give you an explanation. I mean, some of you may know Sanskrit. See, ma agacha means don't come here. Ma agacha means don't go. Ma vada means don't speak. So whenever you use the word ma, it means negation. No, it means non-existence. Ma actually corresponds to the very idea of something which doesn't exist at all. The other word is ya. Ya is a pronoun in the feminine gender. See, so now you don't use a pronoun to denote something which doesn't exist at all. You can't use a pronoun. This bag, with this is a pronoun, this bag exists in front of me. So ya indicates the existence and ma indicates non-existence. Now can there be something which is a combination of neither existence nor non-existence? Or it can be a combination of existence and non-existence? How can it be? There can be. In fact, this world is something like that. It is neither existence nor non-existence in the absolute sense. It is not non-existence because we experience this world, we live in this world, we are part of this world. This world is very much a reality when we are living in this world. But we know very well, anybody, any student, any school student can tell you the world that we are living in can never be real in the true sense of the term. Because if something is to be called real, if something should be called real, it should be the same in the past, in the present and future. The world did not exist before it came into existence. The world that we see around us. Now you may have read in newspapers, you see Mars, for example. There is a river which is 1,500 miles long river, which is hundreds of miles wide. It existed several million years back. Now it doesn't exist. So that's what the scientists say. You may have read in newspapers. That may be the condition of the world in which we are living after several billions of years. We can't be sure. So, what does it mean? The world changes. So anything which is changing cannot be real in the true sense of the term. Because it's capital letter R. You can't use it. It is not eternal. It is not everlasting. Anything which changes in time, belongs to time. And anything which belongs to time cannot be eternally real, but it cannot be absolutely non-existent. Because we are living in this world. So it is not absolutely non-existent, but we know very well that it is not everlasting. In Sanskrit, we use the word satyam. You find him anyway. The word satya actually means that we remains the same without any change in the past, in the present and future, which remains the same. The world in which we live cannot be real in the true sense of the term, because it will change. Maybe after several millions of years, this world in which we are living would look like what Mars looks like now, right now. We may read in newspapers. So what does it mean? It is neither non-existent in the absolute sense, because we are experiencing it, we are living in it. It is neither existent in the absolute sense, because it changes. This is Maya. It's a Maya is relativity. It exists from the common sense experience point of view, but it is not eternal. Now, that is what bondage is. Bondage is something which is real when you are within bondage. You realize the relativity of the illusoriness of bondage when you are free from bondage. You realize the relativity of the relative when you come out of the relative, when you realize the absolute. So long as we are within the relative, we consider the relative to be the absolute. That's a real point of view. In other words, we are under the wrong notion that we are bound. And so long as we consider ourselves to be within bondage, we are bound. Now, how we come out of this bondage? When we realize that we are something which doesn't belong to time. We are something which is beyond time. We are something that doesn't change at all. Body certainly is not something like that. Body changes. Body belongs to time. Mind also changes. It belongs to time. Intellect also changes. So what is that within us? Which never changes. Which beyond time. It transcends time. Which is absolute. Which is beyond relativity. That is called Atman in the language of Vedanta and Yoga. Sometimes it is translated as consciousness, which is immanent, transcendent, and omnipresent, all-pervading. Now, when we realize that we are this Atman, we are this consciousness, we are really free. Now, where did this freedom come from? The freedom doesn't come from anywhere, because the freedom is always here. Freedom doesn't come. So that's why I said earlier, freedom is a kind of self-discovery, the realization of the fact of what we actually are, or removal of the wrong notion that we normally accumulate in our mind, that we are this body, we are this mind, we are the intellect, and so on. Now, this is the highest freedom. This is the freedom in the true sense of the term. It is called spiritual freedom. Now, every human being is directly or indirectly searching for this spiritual freedom. Even our efforts to gain physical freedom is actually an attempt to gain spiritual freedom. But when we are not aware that physical freedom is not what we actually need, then we become satisfied with physical freedom or intellectual freedom, a freedom of speech and so on. Because spiritual freedom is the only source of happiness according to Vedanta. Because that is the only thing which gives us a sense of complete contentment. Anything that you get from the markets at the empirical level, that you can get for money, or through influence, through education, whatever it may be. It stays for some time. It gives us, I'm happy. I've got a good job. I've got a lot of money, got a good status, position, and so on. But that gives you a sense of satisfaction. But the source of satisfaction may vanish tomorrow. So satisfaction also will vanish. So it is not absolute happiness. It gives you freedom for the time being. Money gives you freedom from poverty. Status, reputation gives you freedom from some other feeling of negligence, feeling of non-recognition, and so on. So different things you give you freedom from some relative, non-absolute bondages. But the true freedom is spiritual freedom. And spiritual freedom gives you the feeling, well, I have got something beyond which there is nothing that I can gain for, that I can seek, that I should work for. This spiritual freedom is eternal. Now, this is the destination. Now, yoga is the path to reach this freedom. There are different paths, four different paths are there. The path may differ, may depend upon our own attitudes, our own taste, our own temperament, our own evolution. People who are very active, who are always working with the mind, with the body, you ask them, you discuss philosophy with them, well, they would tell you, well, I have to work. That's the nature. So for people who are work-oriented, who are more or less obsessed with physical or intellectual activity, one particular path of yoga is prescribed in Vedanta and yoga. It's called karma yoga. Karma means action. Yoga means union of the individual with the cosmic. Union of the individual jiva with the cosmic consciousness, which means freedom. That this unity, this identity is freedom. So for a person who is of an active type, his path to freedom is action, not inaction. I'm going to deal with this particular topic in today's class. First, yoga, karma yoga. Now, as I said, you know, there are four paths. These paths are prescribed for people belonging to different attitudes, temperaments, and so on. Now, you find people working very hard day and night for money, for status, and so on. And then, many of them, when they reach a very high level of success in this world, it could be money, it could be the high position, reputation, or whatever may be, still there is a hankering within, there is a hunger within, they are seeking something more. They have got money, they have got status, they have got everything, good house, everything. Still, they're hankering after something. There is discontentment, there is a hunger, there is a feeling of emptiness within. So, otherwise you find there are people who go to an art gallery and they look at the grand painting. Now, what you do? And they get lost. Actually, they are, in fact, they're trying to get freedom. Freedom from the senses. By forgetting the world in which they are living. By identifying themselves with the beauty of the painting. Or when they listen to music, when they get completely lost in it, it is an attempt to get freedom, but freedom of a lower type. So, in other words, there is always a continuous effort on the part of human beings to get more and more, which means they are not satisfied. People generally do not get satisfied with empirical gains, empirical attainments. And even those who become successful in business, accumulating huge wealth, they sometimes lose their psychological health to enjoy the fruits of their work. Millions of dollars in the bank, but the old man is admitted to a psychiatric asylum. So he has gained, he has succeeded, but he's suffering from schizophrenia, anxiety neurosis, maybe melancholia, and different kinds of neurotic or psychotic problems. So people work hard, succeed in material life, they work day and night, but at the end of the day, they become psychological wrecks. They cannot enjoy the fruits of their own labor. So what's the use of this work? And again, Vivekananda gives a graphic description of the dynamics of Maya at work in our daily life. Now, a mother brings up her child, or maybe father brings up his child with great affection, everything. The child becomes a rogue, but the mother cannot shake her attachment from the child, even if after growing up. There is something which binds her to her son, or his son for the matter. Something which she knows to be the source of trouble, but she cannot take her mind off from him. It happens sometimes. Swami Vivekananda defines Maya as a statement of fact. A fact of experience in our daily life. But we understand it is only an illusion the moment we get out of it. When we are within it, it is a reality. Then it becomes a bondage. The moment we get out of it, when we look back, then we can smile. Oh, it was only an illusion. It is only a misunderstanding. When we reach the highest freedom of consciousness. Now, for those who are of a work-oriented type, there is one prescription, one method prescribed in the text of Vedanta and Yoga, that is non-attachment. Now, what is the source of trouble? What's the source of bondage? What's the source of anxiety, melancholia, depression among people who work day and night, who succeed in material life, but then they are not able to enjoy the beauty, the sublimity, the charm, the music of life. Life is an eternal misery for them. They may be attending a board meeting, they may be CEOs, they may be smiling at you, but within them there is depression, they say melancholia. So yoga and Vedanta prescribe one method for those who are oriented towards karma, action, that is non-attachment. We cannot run away from work. That's an important point, which all great teachers of yoga and Vedanta, including Sri Krishna, Sri Ramakrishna, Shankaracharya, Vivekananda, all the great teachers of world religion and world spiritual traditions have taught, that we can never remain inactive for a moment. If we are not physically active, we are hyperactive mentally or intellectually. So there is a verse in the Gita, Neki kasikshanamabi jadu tishthati akarma kurdu. Karidehi avashak karma sarva pragrdijayi gunayi. Because these words have got tremendous spiritual meaning. That's why I want to quote before you. Krishna says in the Gita, not even for one split second you can remain quiet. Even if you are relaxing on an armchair, you are mentally active. You are worrying about something, though you are not physically involved in any activity. So, nobody can escape the reality of action, the reality of work. Either physical action or mental, intellectual action. But at the same time, action brings problems. That also is equally true. You cannot have any action without problems. If not today, tomorrow. even successful action also creates problems. Suppose you work hard for getting something. When you are involved in the hard work for acquiring that object, well, you are anxious. You are certainly not in a state of perfect bliss when you are deeply involved in some work with all anxiety, with all identity and obsession. When you have already succeeded in getting that object, then also you are not very happy because you are very anxious not to lose it. Many rich people are very much anxious. What about the stock exchange? How the stock exchange is functioning? They are very much anxious. You see, they are very so. They suffer from all kinds of neurotic and psychological problems: anxiety, neurosis, melancholia, depression, and so on. So even when they have acquired success, they acquired wealth, they'll be watching at the computer, anxiously watching the latest position in the stock exchange. So this never comes to an end. And when they lose money, then also they are certainly not happy. So anything in this material world brings you something which is not very pleasant in its train. Even successful action, successful activities create problems. So on the one hand, we had to face the reality, you can never remain inactive. Action is a fact of our life. If not physically, at least intellectually, even if you have nothing to do, you're relaxing in a park, your mind will be hyperactive, worried about many things. So the problem of the reality of action, on the one hand, and the problem of actions and other unpleasant experiences that come in their train. So how to solve this problem? So in the Vedantic and yogic scriptures, the great teachers of ancient spiritual traditions have given one description: be active, but don't be a slave of action. Is it possible? In fact, what is meant by being a slave of action? When we are engaged in action, and when action takes its toll psychologically and physically, when we become anxious about the result of action, we work as slaves. When you work, but without any worry with regard to the results of your work, you work as a master. So there is a way out. The way out is this: you try to work as a master and not as a slave. The words which I quoted earlier, you know, if you do not try to become masters of action, if you do not try to work as a master, you will be forced to work as a slave, because action is unavoidable and action creates problems. So the only way to be active and at the same time escape the problems of actions is this: act without attachment, act with perfect non-attachment. That will enable us to work as masters and not as slaves. That will take us to freedom. So karma yoga is a sure path which takes us to freedom. There have been great karma yogis in the world, those who practice this karma yoga, who traditionally did not believe in a transcendental reality, God or heaven or anything. But they were embodiments of unselfishness. Remember, it doesn't mean that you should be indifferent. I use the word non-attachment or detachment. I use one word here. We should be completely non-attached to the results of our actions. It doesn't mean that we should be indifferent, that we should be negligent, that we should leave everything to destiny or fate. Not at all. It is the other way around. A real karma yogi, a person who practices karma yoga, can act much more efficiently, much more intensely, and much more effectively than a person who is working with a mind obsessed with the result of what happens to his actions. Because when he is obsessed with attachment, when he is so much worried about what happens to his actions, whether they will produce the expected results or not, about 60% of his attention is lost. Anxiety distracts the mind. So mind is not fully focused on the work at hand. You are so much worried, you are so much anxious about what happens, about the result of your action. So what happens? This worry or anxiety will distract the mind, and mind loses about 60% of its energy. On the other hand, if we can work with full concentration, without any worry, without any anxiety about the results of your action, whole mind is focused on the work you are doing, and the work will be certainly much more efficient, much more effective, and such work will produce far superior results. Now, I can give two examples. Examples from two different different personalities. One example is the example of Shankaracharya. Now, if you look up any dictionary of philosophy, any standard book on world thought, you find the first name in Indian philosophical tradition is Shankaracharya. Now, today we are reading Gita because he wrote a commentary on this book. This book was not, the Bhagavad Gita was not a universal classic that we know it today before Shankaracharya wrote a commentary. His masterly touch turned this small book of 700 verses into a universal classic. And what about the Upanishad? What about Vedanta philosophy? Vedanta philosophy as we understand it today is practically a creation of Shankara. Vedanta philosophy existed in the Vedic literature, but the superstructure of Vedantic metaphysics, ethics, all other epistemology, all these different aspects of Vedantic philosophy were practically created by Shankaracharya when he wrote commentaries on these Upanishads, which constitute the philosophical aspect of Vedic literature. So, and do you know how long he lived? 32 years. That was the span of his life. 32 years. And you know what he did? He is the writer of the greatest metaphysical works in Sanskrit tradition, in Vedantic tradition, in Indian philosophical tradition. And another thing, he is the author of the most beautiful, most sublime Sanskrit poetry. You know, if you read, even if you don't know Sanskrit language, if you read Shankaracharya's sublime devotional poetry, you feel yourself, you'll be transported to another realm. Okay. Now, and do you know what he did? He traveled all over India 4 times. And India means today Sri Lanka right up to Tibet, near Tibet. That means to Badrinath, Kedarnath, just close to the Tibetan plateau. And today's Afghanistan, Bangladesh, the huge Indian subcontinent, he traveled 4 times. Even today, if you travel from one end of the country to the other end, you'll be tired. Even if you travel by plane, you'll be tired. But he traveled 4 times, 1300 years back. He was born in 778. And passed away in 810 AD. And he was the one who established Vedantic philosophy by defeating the anarchists, the nihilists, and the atheists, and all the diabolical traditions that prevailed during his time. And he is the founder of the sannyasa tradition. 10 orders of sannyasa, 10 orders of monastic tradition he founded. And there are hundreds of temples all over India, right from the extreme southern point to northmost Himalayan region, which he sanctified, where he went, he prescribed the different forms of worship, and he renovated hundreds of temples. And you know, when he started his work, when he was less than 7 years old, from his birthplace, he traveled 1700 kilometers in search of his teacher. And about Shankaracharya, Gandhiji has written a famous statement. The great Shankara saved Hinduism for total destruction, which the British Empire, with all its military might behind it, could not undo in 190 years. That's what Gandhiji wrote, within 32 years. And he never felt tired, never exhausted. I can give another example of Mahatma Gandhi. Another example. Gandhiji was, I don't have good details, many of you are familiar with his life. He was the one who led the Indian freedom struggle. And once C.F. Andrews, a European disciple of Gandhiji, he was a staunch Catholic, asked Gandhiji, Mahatma Gandhi, "Gandhi, why don't you go on holiday, take rest and go on holidays?" This is a question he asked in the young Indian rights. Now, Gandhi used to sleep only for nearly 4 hours a day. He used to work for sometimes 18, sometimes 20 hours a day. He's a very hard-working person. But he never took rest, never went on holidays. So Gandhi said, "Who is tired? You are tired, why don't you go on holidays?" Gandhi said, "Who is tired?" And what Gandhiji, one of the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, one of the brother disciples of Vivekananda, said, "He is knocking at the doors of Brahmajnana." Now, why am I giving this example? How could these two types of personalities, Gandhiji was a great political leader and also a great spiritual personality, and Shankaracharya, who was a great spiritual and religious leader, one of the greatest India has ever produced. See, both these two great men did so much. In the case with regard to Shankara, he lived only for 32 years and he was an epoch maker in the history of Indian spiritual tradition. And Gandhi is also a most unforgettable figure in India's history. How could they do so much within their lifetime? They did so much, but they never did the work with any sense of attachment. Gandhiji wrote a commentary on the Gita. In fact, the title itself is Anasakti Yoga, the Yoga of Non-Attachment. That is the title of the book which he wrote. So what I mean to say, all these great men did so much, but they did so much, still the effect of what they did within their short lifespan continues to be felt in our own times. Because they could do all this with a sense of complete non-attachment. So non-attachment enables us to work as masters, not as slaves. And it helps us to work more effectively, more efficiently. You can do work, you can enjoy the fruits of your work. When you are involved in work, you can be relaxed. And after the work is over, you can be relaxed. When the results of the work are not up to the expectation, you are not depressed. When the results of the work is much more than your expectation, you are not overjoyed. So that helps us to work as masters, not as slaves. So attachment binds us, it brings bondage, and non-attachment takes us away from bondage, it leads us to freedom. So this is the psychological aspect of Karma Yoga. Second point is this: you are able to do work, to our work more efficiently, because mental energy and physical energy can be more effectively concentrated on the work that we are doing. That makes the work much more effective, much more efficient. Second point is, when we really feel, well, oh, I am doing so much of work, then only we become tired. In fact, if we are doing the work, and at the same time we are conscious that we are doing a lot of work, then we become tired. We become exhausted. That's the point. So, and when we become exhausted due to attachment to the work we are doing, or the results of the work that we are doing, we are within bondage. But if we can do work as a play, then we can be relaxed at the time of doing work and also after the work. But as I said earlier, it doesn't mean either indifference or negligence. In fact, Lord Krishna anticipates this problem. See, if you tell anybody, well, you should do the work without attachment, without hankering for the results of the work. If a businessman or executive of a company, if he is asked to work without a sense of motive, with a definite goal to be achieved, he will be puzzled. How is it really possible? Well, maybe anticipating this problem, Lord Krishna solves this problem in one of his slokas. The sloka is this, those who are interested can remember. Saktaha karmani avidvamso yatha kurvanti bhairata kuriyat vidvan tatha asaktaha chikishuhu lokasangraham. This is this law. I shall explain in English. So here Krishna gives the example of two types of people. A group of people, they are very efficient, they're full of zeal, full of enthusiasm, and full of attachment, full of identity with a definite purpose. A skillful organizer, that he is doing wonderful work and he is producing wonderful result. On the one hand. On the other hand, there is another person who is not attached to the results of his action, but who is as efficient, as enthusiastic, and as effective in his work as the former. The only difference is, the former is, in the earlier example, the person is so much obsessed with what he's doing. While doing the work, he's anxious what will happen. And when the results are not up to the expectation, he becomes depressed. When the results exceed his expectations, he become overjoyed. In the former example. In the latter example, that person is very active, works 24 hours of the day, very enthusiastic, very efficient. He considers his duty and his lot of application and devotion he display in his work area. But he is completely non-attached. Now what happens? In fact, in the latter example, the person who is practicing non-attachment has got two advantages. One advantage, he will be able to focus more energy, more effectively on the work he is doing, because he is not worried. In the In the former example, the person who is working with anxiety and with attachment to the results of his actions is so anxious. He is very efficient, very enthusiastic, but he is so much obsessed with what he is doing. So anxious with regard to the results of his actions. And this anxiety will take away a lot of his mental energy, and it creates hypertension and diabetes and so many other problems. Depression, melancholia, and schizophrenic problems and so on, depending upon the cases. Though he is very effective. In the latter example, that person is doing work with the same enthusiasm, with the same zeal, with the same efficiency, but he is not a slave. He is not negligent or indifferent towards his work, but he thinks, well, whatever he is doing is his duty. If he is a strong believer in God, it becomes much more easy for him. So many of the scriptures give one prescription. Mentally, he can surrender the results of his actions to God. No matter what religion he is practicing, what religious tradition he belongs to, it makes no difference. If he can surrender the results of his actions to God, it becomes easy. But there have been great men like Buddha who did not believe in God, who still were role models for karma yoga. But they did their duty for the good of the world. So, this is the main difference. So, karma yoga helps us to be free while doing the work and to do the work with sense of relaxation, with a sense of perfect equanimity. This equanimity is a very, very, very important term. In fact, in karma yoga tradition, this mental equanimity, a tranquility of mind, if we can remain mentally calm and quiet and serene while being engaged in work, that is a sign of karma yogi, a real practitioner of karma yoga. It doesn't mean that you become cold. Remember, a karma yogi doesn't become cold in his relations. He has got consideration for others. He is warm-hearted. But within him, he has a sense of complete non-attachment. Note that a karma yogi becomes cold-hearted, because non-attachment sometimes can be wrongly interpreted. It could be interpreted as a kind of coldness in our relationship with people around us, or as a kind of indifference or negligence towards the duties and responsibilities. Not at all. In fact, for those who believe in God, for those who believe in religious or spiritual tradition, it becomes very easy, because for such a practitioner, for a believer, he can turn his every action into an act of worship. In this tradition, there is a gradual evolution you find. For the primitive person, even worship is a work. For an advanced spiritual person, work becomes worship. For a primitive person, even the most solemn act of meditation or spiritual practice becomes a mechanical work. That's the most primitive level. But as we go further and further, the line of demarcation between work and worship gradually disappears. And work itself becomes worship. And at the higher level, there is only worship only, there is no work. Our whole existence becomes a kind of spiritual practice. because every act is looked upon as a worship. So, whatever we do, psychologically, mentally, physically, intellectually, spiritually, it becomes an act of worship. As I said, you know, there is no holiday in spiritual life. At the beginning stage, perhaps spirituality, we practice spirituality maybe for 1 hour in the morning or 1 hour in the evening. But the highest level, the difference between the secular and spiritual vanishes. Whole life becomes spiritual. There is no such thing as secular activity at all. The line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual vanishes. Because work itself vanishes, only worship exists, because work is also worship. Now, this is the process of spiritualization of our entire life as a whole. Here, I must tell you, because whenever we talk about surrendering the fruits of our action to God, I need to give you a footnote here. The idea of God, that's very important. In fact, our idea or our concept of God very much depends upon our own spiritual or cultural evolution. So, as the Bible says, you know, God created man in his image. It is true that man also creates God in his image. Because our understanding, our concept of God very much depends upon our own spiritual or cultural evolution. A primitive man thinks, or primitive person thinks, that God lives in a place of worship. God is happy if you read a book. God is unhappy if you don't read that book, or if you read the book of another religious tradition. This is the primitive. And at the higher level, we start looking upon God as an immanent principle, as the reality residing in all living beings, as a reality which is all-pervading, as a reality which is transcendental. So the entire creation is identified as an expression of God. So God doesn't create this world and stands outside of it. God is present in every living being in this world. That is the Vedanta, that is the principle of, that's the dictum of Vedanta and also yoga. So, and that God is compassionate. He opens his doors not only to believers but also non-believers, because they are also created by him. If you say non-believers are created by devil, then you are admitting the devil has a place in God's realm. You are admitting two realities, which is from an ontological point of view, which is ridiculous. God is a supreme reality. So there is no such thing as evil. Evil, the so-called evil, is only the lack of awareness of our own true nature. So this is the point you have to remember. So when we think upon God as the compassionate, as the all-pervading reality, as the immanent reality, as the transcendental reality, who opens his doors to everyone in this world, who makes no distinction between religious traditions, spiritual traditions, or cultural, national traditions. If you can think of such a God, then if we can surrender the results of our action to such a God, then karma yoga becomes very easy. So we can live in this world with a smile. We can work 24 hours of the day with a smile. Because we are not attached to the results of work, we are able to smile. We are able to work as masters. Attachment always brings bondage. Here, when I am talking about attachment, I should make one point clear. I am not talking about attachment in human relationship. I am not talking about attachment of a mother to her child, or the attachment of child to her, to his mother, nothing like that. I am here talking about our obsession with the material results of the work we are doing. the an extreme form of result orientation. That's what I'm talking about. When we forget the transcendental, the higher spiritual values, when we are obsessed with the present, when we are obsessed with the kind of result orientation, when we judge everything in terms of practical benefits of what we do, that's what I'm talking about. So, in this context, a kind of non-attachment enables us to work with sense of freedom, and we are able to work as masters. Because attachment is a chain that binds us. And non-attachment is the instrument which cuts this chain and takes us to freedom. As I said, we can never avoid work in this world. As everyone knows, and there is no need to repeat this idea. Everyone will have to work, some kind of work. And work creates problems. Even if you remain physically inactive, you are mentally active. You are imagining. That also is action. Mental action is much more damaging than physical action very often. Imagination is much more damaging sometimes. Wrong imaginations. So, no one can escape the reality of work. And no one can help admitting the fact that work creates problems. So how to escape, how to save also from these problems, how to remain active and at the same time be free, how one can be active and at the same time avoid these problems, that method is non-attachment towards the result of what we are doing. This is the solution. In fact, that is the essence of Karma Yoga. I shall continue this discussion in the next class. If we have got any, we have half an hour for interaction. That can be much more effective because the subject is a bit technical. So we can have an active discussion if you have from different points of view.
So I had a comment on the four different kinds of yoga. From the Vedantic perspective, what is there one particular path? You've often said that it's up to the temperament and the personality of the person at the devotee,
yeah.
What direction they tend to want to go in. There's another school of thought that's more integral, where there's a certain tradition that believes that you need to combine the
yes.
four.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious what your views
yes,
are.
Yes,
about that.
Yes. I'm going to deal with other yogas and the synthesis of these four yogas in the next classes. We have eight more classes. You know. So in today's class, I wanted to confine myself to Karma Yoga, this particular aspect. In reality, we have to combine this. But before talking about the synthesis of the four yogas, I wanted to focus on the Karma Yoga aspect. Because that's where we start. We don't have to reject anything or accept anything new. We have to just turn our action in another direction. Give a new direction to our action. Then becomes Karma Yoga. So I wanted to start with Karma Yoga. That's what I wanted to say. The uniqueness of Karma Yoga is it demands the least from you. It doesn't demand too much from you. You can just give a new direction to your activity, whatever it may be. You don't have to accept a new philosophy. You don't have to give up what you are doing. Just give it a new direction. So when I talk about other three yogas, I shall discuss those points. But in reality, in our practical life, we do combine these four yogas. That's true. Because when you believe, when you are engaged in some kind of spiritual practices, you are actually practicing bhakti yoga, the path of devotion. And when you are just analyzing, what am I? What's the purpose of my life? when you try to philosophize some of the fundamental questions of human life, you are actually practicing Jnana Yoga. I mean, you are entering the realm of Jnana Yoga. But then, in all these yogas, we need to practice certain internal disciplines and also external disciplines, which are related to Raja Yoga, Yama Niyama. So I shall come to those topics when I'm dealing with them. Yes.
So Swami, you spoke of non-attachment and you also spoke of worship. I have two problems. How do you, when you have non-attachment, where do you derive your motivation? And then, you know, for somebody who is skeptic or agnostic or atheist, what is the meaning of worship?
Yes, yes. In fact, I was using that term only in the context of people who believe in God, who are practicing some kind of spiritual religious tradition. But for an agnostic like Buddha, for example, doing good for the good of others, doing work for the good of others, that is enough. In fact, that will take them to the highest spiritual destination. An agnostic need not and cannot, of course, accept a personal God. But an agnostic can accept certain fundamental spiritual humanistic values. Buddha is a classic example. So, if we really want to lead a good life, unselfish life, we can do, and we can do our duty with idea in mind. Well, it should be for the good of others. That should be the position of an agnostic. But those who believe in some religious tradition, those who believe in some in established spiritual practices, will find it more easy because they can associate their faith with the Karma Yoga idea. That's what I was talking about. Even an atheist can practice Karma Yoga, because even an atheist or an agnostic may admit, well, there are certain fundamental human values, universal humanistic values that we have to accept. They can certainly practice Karma Yoga. They are spiritual, may not be necessarily religious. They can be spiritual.
What is the Vedantic perspective on like original sin, Adam and Eve, and the fall of humankind? You see that in a lot of early stories, you know, the paradise and then man's fall, you know, which to me is a metaphor of when human species came, evolved over millions of years from more instinctual, animalistic existence to the awareness and consciousness, which developed over tens of thousands of years of evolution, if we believe that. Does Vedanta believe in physical evolution?
Vedanta doesn't accept the idea of a personalized evil. Like, for example, Satan tempting Adam to eat the fruit of knowledge and the consequent fall. That is not acceptable to Vedantic tradition. In fact, Vedanta believes in the doctrine of ignorance, error, theory of error it is called, in contrast to the theory of evil. There is no such thing as evil in this world. Because if you admit evil, then you are giving evil an ontological status, the status of an ontological reality, which means God exists, evil also exists. Both are realities. But in Vedanta, there is only one reality, that is consciousness, or we can say in monotheistic tradition, you call God, is the only reality. So whatever, we all do wrong things, people commit wrong things, not because of temptation by Satan, but because of their ignorance of the fact that they are consciousness within. The ignorance of their own true nature. The ignorance of their own true nature. That is the error. So Vedanta accepts, it upholds the theory of error and not the theory of evil. But I tell you, in non-Vedantic tradition, in popular Hinduism, in the stories of Puranas, mythological books, there are many of these ideas mentioned, hell, heaven, and so on. But there is no idea of the devil tempting man to eat the fruit of knowledge and that leading to his fall from his realm. That is altogether non-existent in popular Hinduism as well. But in monotheistic popular Hindu tradition, the idea of hell and heaven is there. But there is always the idea that God is supreme. That the devil or the evil can never have the status of an ontological reality. God is the supreme reality, nothing beyond. That's idea. That's one line of demarcation between Vedanta and monotheistic, I mean, this Abrahamic religious traditions. Please.
Yes. Please. Kananda writes on the subject, speaking of proper courage and false courage. He writes, "This world is not for cowards, do not try to fly. Look not for success or failure, join yourself to the perfectly unselfish will and work on." And you know the rest of the passage. But the question I have is about this requirement of some genuine courage to be non-attached.
Oh, you mean the requirement of a genuine courage to be non-attached?
Yes.
Yes. That courage takes the form of unselfishness, because attachment is always associated with selfishness. If you are totally unselfish, then we can remain non-attached. So,
and that's where the courage is.
Yes, yes.
See.
That will make us totally free. That will cut the chains that bind us to this world. The bondage will be broken. That's the idea. Yes.
Swami, could you comment on, it seems to me that in any path, in order to begin that path, you have to develop a provisional ego in order to develop the qualities required to develop what you're talking about, non-attachment and so forth.
False ego.
You have to develop a provisional ego.
A professional ego. Oh,
provisional
ego.
In that, in the sense that you don't yet have the awakened divine ego, but you have the false ego, which is saying, you know, I need this me, mine, and I. So, because otherwise, it seems to me that if you don't have a personal God, or the provisional ego either is a personal God, or it's like you said, humanistic provisional ego. But it seems like that has a very important part to play in even what he just talked about, developing that courage and so forth.
Yes, you know, professional ego, but for a karma yogi, he can be efficient as a professional and be sincere to his profession without ego, without developing professional ego. Of course, it depends upon how you interpret the word, you know, professional ego. If you say professional attachment.
No, I said provisional, in that it just provides him with a way in which to make the journey from the unawakened status to the awakened status.
Yes, you know, that's why at the beginning we should be attached, but we should also be capable of being detached. That's the idea. In the beginning, you should be fully devoted to the work you are doing. But if you can be devoted without being attached, you can also detach yourself from that work, then that only enables you to work as a free man. Otherwise, it becomes a bondage. So all these great men of action, women of action, whom we consider to be role models in Karma Yoga, they did so much of work with, apparently with so much of devotion, but we may call it professional ego. But they could also detach themselves. That no, detachment part is the result of their inherent non-attachment.
Right.
No. See, Krishna makes one point with key. He says, in real action, somebody watching you may think you are attached, observing your professional attachment, your professional ego may think, well, you are extremely attached. But within you, you can remain non-attached. So the professional ego is the reading of an external person who may be watching your enthusiasm, your energy, your devotion to your chosen profession. But within your own mind, we can remain detached.
No, that's not what I'm not sure I'm making myself clear. What I'm saying is that in order to remain detached, you have to create a pattern of remembrance of wanting to be detached, because it's natural to become attached.
Yes, yes.
So, hence that being the case, I'm saying you have to develop some internal method, or however that's developed in your inner self, in order to keep that happening.
Yes.
The nature of the ego is such that it wants to reattach.
Now, this problem is directly addressed in the Gita itself. Krishna makes one point. Don't teach a person the art of detachment on a fine morning. Na buddhi vedam janayed ajnanam karma sankinam. See, in the Gita you find, Krishna never teaches Arjuna the science of non-attachment at the beginning itself. In the Gita, if you observe, you find when Arjuna was trying to run away from the field of action, Krishna first tells him, be attached, do work with desire. Because if you run away from the field of action, your friends and also your enemies will belittle you, they will ridicule you. See, Hatova Prapsisi Surkam, you find in the second chapter, 33-34 verse, you find there are four verses. In one verse, Krishna tells Arjuna, if you run away from the field of action, they will think bhaya renadu paradam, means they will think you are running away after fear. That is worse than death for you. You are a man of high reputation. Therefore, you work with attachment. You work with a strong motive. This is the first instruction given to Arjuna by Krishna. Because Arjuna was trying to run away from the field of action, not because of detachment or non-attachment, but because of laziness, lethargy, and ignorance. So somebody who is lazy, who is ignorant, and who thinks that avoiding action is the essence of Karma Yoga, for such a person, the first step is he should do work sincerely, with ambition, with desire. And then Krishna teaches him the science of work without attachment. So, from a state of inertia and inaction, one should graduate to the level of action with desire. Desire, action with ambition. At the third stage, we must evolve to the next step. That means action without desire. That is how the evolution. So, one can never reach the level of Karma Yoga or action without desire from a state of inertia or laziness. If you are lazy, first you be active. If you cannot be active as a Karma Yogi, be active, have desire, have some goal to achieve. You will dream big as all these things. Think big, achieve something, work with ambition and desire. And then at the next stage, you work with the same enthusiasm, but without desire, without attachment. This is how the evolution takes place. I wanted to deal with this subject next class. There are four levels of evolution, psychologically speaking. how a person evolves. The worst and the most, undesirable state is a state of inertia, laziness, inaction, and sleepishness. Lower stage. From that, a person should try to reach the next stage, action with desire, motive with a definite goal. What we call dream big, achieve something grand, make a lot of money. The third stage, the same work you must be able to do, but without attachment. The third stage. And the fourth stage, as I said, you know, every action becomes an act of worship. Because action without desire becomes your natural character. That is the last, fourth stage. So one should never try to reach the third stage directly from the lowest stage. A lazy man, first of all, should give up his laziness and work hard, make money, achieve and become something in this world. And then he should try to do the same work with the same enthusiasm, but without any attachment. And the fourth highest stage, this action without attachment becomes your natural character. As in Buddha, Vivekananda, Gandhi, maybe Martin Luther, all these great men. There are many, many people. The whole world, all nations have produced such outstanding examples. Okay? Yes.
Somebody, you mentioned about the evolution of going to the fourth stage where you're automatically performing without the objective of a return. And there is a stage where you say that you have to get off on lethargy and achieve and think big and do big. But then obviously in that stage when you are evolving to the third stage, you do get into disappointment because you are expecting a result back because you're putting your efforts and you want that to return. That creates the motivation and the reward which evolves you finally to achieve that. So in that second stage, you do experience disappointment when you don't achieve something when you're doing it, right? I mean, you can't be like without disappointment at that level.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yeah, yes, yes. Now,
so how do you manage that?
Yes, at the second stage, when a person is very active, very successful, and still he faces disappointment, depression, and he becomes disillusioned, though he has put up his best effort, that moment, he will realize the importance of, or he will realize the cause of his disappointment. Because he's a naturally active person. But he will realize that he has done his best, but still the results are not up to the expectation. And it creates problems like disappointment or disillusionment. That experience will help him to graduate the third stage. He will not give up action. But for such person, he should keep in touch with these great ideas. Gita or any great book. If she comes to become acquainted with the principles of Karma Yoga, suddenly it will flash on his mind, oh, I have disappointment, though I am not a lazy person, still in spite of my best effort, I am not able to achieve happiness. And if you read Karma Yoga, suddenly you find, well, it is possible for one to be happy and also remain active. And that is the path of non-attachment. It depends upon the context. A lazy man may try to pretend to be a karma yogi. But actually, in fact, Krishna uses a very strong language. He is a hypocrite. Lord Krishna in the Gita, when he deals with this subject, he says, a person who apparently does nothing, he says, well, I am not interested in material welfare. But mentally he is full of imagination, he's dreaming, he's imagining what all I could achieve if I could get all those things. He is not a man of renunciation or a woman of renunciation. he pretends to be above all desires. Such a person is lazy and is a hypocrite. For such a person, he should give up his laziness and work with desire, with a motive. But then if you are really an active person, if you have done your best, still if you don't feel happiness, if you are disappointment, then naturally you will understand, well, I am not lazy, but there is something wrong with the way I am doing things. I have done my best, still I am not able to enjoy happiness. There is something wrong. I have to change my attitude. And if you read books like Gita, suddenly it will flash in your mind. This is a path. That's the idea.
How to practice non-attachment to the mind? To
our own mind. Well, non-attachment, you know, what all thoughts flash in our mind, how to remain free from involvement with our own thought process. The one method is to remind ourselves that we are not this mind. So what all thought currents flash in the mind, let them come, but I'm not attached to them. So you can welcome those thought currents, but you can come here, but I'm a spectator. This is called a witness attitude. Sometimes the Mandukya Upanishad, Mandukya Karya, witness attitude. You are the consciousness. So whatever comes to your mind or your intellect, all these ideas are just like players appearing on the stage. You are not involved. You are the Supreme Consciousness. You are the Atman. If this idea we can practice, then these thought currents won't disturb you. We cannot psychologically drive away thoughts. It is not possible. Any kind of interaction with these thoughts will create problems. Even if you confront them aggressively, then also it creates problems. If you identify them, welcome them, then also it creates problems. So you neither welcome these thoughts nor try to drive away those thoughts. Just remain witness. That's the only way to remain detached from the thought currents flashing in the mind. Witness at it. We are witness. See, witness is not directly involved. Witness is aware of the thoughts flashing in the mind. But witness is not involved. That word is used in Sanskrit, sakshi, which means you are aware of it, but you are not involved. In a sense of non-involvement and a sense of awareness. These two ideas are combined in the witness concept. We should not welcome those thoughts. We should not aggressively confront them either. Just remain detached.
So the thoughts that we use to function in the world, we, as we mature, select the ones that are more toward the good. But you do need to have the mind that you relate to function in the world. So at some point you do have to use it.
But all the time, if we keep ourselves familiar, acquainted with these Vedantic ideas, the idea that we are the consciousness, we are not this body or mind, then that will help us. If we constantly practice this process, this sense of non-identity with the thought currents flashing in the mind, that will slowly help us. A kind of non-identity. If you identify with those thought currents, they will create problems. Identification can be either negative or positive. Either you welcome them or you try to drive them away. No, don't come to me. Then you'll be always thinking about it. Even negatively try to avoid them, you'll be thinking about them. As I said earlier in the earlier classes, you know. You welcome them or you aggressively avoid them. Both will bring your mind in contact with those thoughts, which creates problems. So remain witness. So witness attitude is generally. The method is described in Yoga Vasishta, in Yoga, in Patanjali Yoga Shastra, in Gita, and in Vedanta. Many books, this is. In Upanishads also. Sakshi means witness. That's the point. Witness is not involved. You don't welcome them, you don't drive them away either. Both are. So I think we are time is now. Okay. Any doubts?
No, I was just thinking, it was Martin Luther King's birthday, and I went to talk, and it was about how he was a drum major, or that was a metaphor, and because he led people, and he was ahead there in the work for freedom for black Americans, and. Then in one way you can see that's very egoistic. You're the drum major, you're first. And it's like saying, oh, I'm first. I'm wanting all those kinds of things, that's the ego drum major. But it also means that he's working for all those people, trying to help them. And when he, I think just before he was assassinated or sometime earlier, he wanted to write on his epitaph something that just, I don't want to be known as a leader or like a Nobel Peace Prize winner. I want to just be known as a person who has helped others.
This is Vedanta in action. Yes. In fact, you find all great men who have worked with great enthusiasm for a noble cause without any selfish motive are really practicing karma yoga. Anywhere in the world, in any culture, in any tradition, believers and also non-believers, anybody who works hard with a noble mind, with a noble idea, noble goal in mind, without any selfish motive, they are actually practicing karma yoga. In Gita and other books, these ideas are systematically explained. But you find this this idea practiced, being practiced by many great men, in many traditions, many cultures, anywhere. All great people were consciously or unconsciously practitioners of karma yoga. Action without desire. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Peace, Peace, Peace.